So one of the stories of Cambridge folklore is the day in 1958 when a batted Austin 7 found itself on top of Senate House. And the Cambridge Austin 7 and Vintage Car Club are planning to recreate that particular stunt. And joining me to talk about that is Paul Lawrence from the Car Club. Hello, Paul. Good to see you.
Hello there.
Thanks very much for coming into 105. It's not actually going to be the Senate House itself, though, quite disappointingly, really.
No, I'm afraid it's not actually going to be the Senate House. We did ask, but the university said no on this occasion. So
I guess they'd be just as pleased about it today as they were back in 1958 were that to happen.
I think they are very pleased about that. But we are going to recreate it, and we're going to recreate it in Jesus Green. And we're going to have the help of the Cambridge University Officer Training Corps.
Okay.
And they are going to put up for us a representation of the Senate House, and using the methods that we used back in 1958, we're going to reconstruct the lifting of a real Austin 7.
And when you say representation, what sort of construction are they going to be putting together for us?
Well, it's going to be a wooden platform, basically.
Okay.
To represent the Senate House. But the car we're going to be lifting is a genuine 1929 Austin 7 saloon. Similar to the original prank, it won't have an engine in it to make it slightly lighter.
Yes, that probably would have helped them. So the sort of methods you're going to be using to do that will be pretty much as we understand it, what happened in 1958.
Yeah, pretty much along the same lines, really. I mean, back in 1958, the plan, although it happened in June 1958, the plan was actually hatched probably a year before that.
And, I guess something like this does need a bit of planning, actually, both for you and for them. Back in the 50s.
It did. It took a lot of planning. And Peter Davey, who was the ringleader at the time, he was there at Cambridge University studying mechanical sciences. And he actually had some accommodation opposite the Senate House. And he felt that the roof cried out to be made more interesting. And he thought the way he'd do that is by getting an Austin 7 and placing that on the roof. So you're right, a whole lot of planning to go into that. But they did have a stroke of luck as well, because a few weeks before, there was some building work that was going on next to King's College, and there had been some scaffolding that had been left lying around there, so they borrowed the scaffolding and they used that to make their lifting frame.
So the car and presumably what you're going to be doing is going to be in full public view, whereas this would have been done, I would have thought, under cover of darkness.
Indeed, this it was actually at 2 o'clock in the morning when they started started the operation. So of course they had the darkness to contend with, and they actually picked May Week in Cambridge, because they thought the only people that might be around then might be revellers who maybe would have had too much to drink, so may not have noticed what was going on.
Everybody else would probably have the good sense to stay indoors during May Week, I guess, as well.
Indeed, maybe they would do, and they did get away with it. And I mean, it wasn't without issues when they started. Started to lift the car.
They went up as one car then. It didn't sort of like take bits out, because sometimes you see, I guess the Royal Marines do this sort of thing, don't they? You see a car, they take it apart, they put it up again over the other side of the arena. But this was like one solid thing going up on a hoist of some description.
It was pretty much one solid thing. I mean, it had no back axle on it, so the wheels were actually placed, lent up against the car once it was on the roof. But on
okay.
the whole...
And as you mentioned, no engine either.
No engine either, just to keep that weight down. But as they started to... As they started to pull it up, it looked like the derrick that they'd made was starting to bend, and they didn't think it was going to go, but they stuck with it, and sure enough, it started to rise, got a few feet up, and then something slipped on the derrick, and it slipped down and crashed on the floor. And they had to wait for the dust to settle, make sure nobody had heard them, and they hadn't. So they continued and managed to get the car right to the top of the Senate roof and then push it out onto the ridge.
I'm actually just as intrigued as to how they got it down again, rather as to how it got up there.
Well, getting
it down... Was somebody else's job, presumably.
Well, that's right. I mean, getting it down was more of a job than actually getting it up there. It stayed there for a week... and the police and the fire brigade did their level best to try and get it down. They couldn't get it down. The civil defence force tried. They couldn't get it down. And in the end, they had to cut the car up with oxyacetylene and bring it down bit by bit.
Dear. Are you aware of anyone? Maybe you've been in touch with some of the people involved in the stunt at the time.
We have. We've been in touch with Peter Davey. He lives down in Cornwall now.
Right.
And he was the ringleader and the main organiser.
Twitching his curtains, as you were saying, and looking out across to the Senate.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't until 2008 that the actual identities of those that were involved became public, and they then explained how they did it. But as I say, we have been in touch with Peter Davey. He's very interested in the project. Sadly, sadly he's not able to come up to Cambridge on the 8th, but he wishes us well and we'll be watching with interest to see how we get on.
I'm sure you're going to capture this on video or anything for people to see.
Oh, certainly, yeah. We're certainly going to have lots of photographs, lots of interest in it. So, yes, it's going to be great.
Tell me about the Austin 7 car. How many, this, you know, when was it actually in production from and to?
It was in production from 1922 to 1939. And it was the first car, really, that was made available to the public. On the whole, it was the first affordable car that people could afford. It was that one step up from a motorcycle and a sidecar.
And this was would have been a British-made car as well.
It was made at Long Bridge in Birmingham.
Right, and what I guess became British Leyland, Rover, and whatever it is now. Not very much, I guess, is the short answer. Maybe a bit of the BMW group.
That's right. Well, it certainly went through many, many, many guises, but Austin was the original manufacturer at that Long Bridge.
And the car then, you said it was 1929, did you say?
So the car we're using is a 1929 saloon.
Right.
But the Austin 7 was built between 1922 and finally finished production in 1939.
Right. How many, because obviously you've managed to get hold of this one, it must be very difficult. Your members are presumably, some of your members will have Austin 7s, which they're keeping nice, polishing, perhaps going out on a summer's Sunday afternoon, assuming we get one or two this year.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I mean there are a lot of Austin 7s around. A lot were made. We couldn't find a willing volunteer to allow us to use their Austin 7 that is actually running and on the road for this project. But we did. In fact, funnily enough, the car that is being supplied is by one of our members, Gerald Walker, and he's actually the son of the gentleman who provided the original car for the original.
Oh, really? So keeping it in the family then, in which case.
Yeah, indeed.
And I guess he would have known about the story growing up as well.
Oh, very much so,
unless he was kept
yeah.
that quiet from even from close family members.
The whole
members.
Thing was kept quiet, really. And it was well known. Across the world it was talked about and published, so people knew about it. But as I say, it wasn't until 2008 that actually the identities of the people involved and how it was actually done became known.
Yeah. I can understand why your members wouldn't necessarily want their working Austin 7s to be risked in this way. If something does go wrong with one of them, what do you do for parts? Do you find a broken one, which is irreparable, and pinch apart from that, or can you get them specially made individual things? Well, what happens?
Well, it's a mixture. I mean, I think you'd be surprised. It's actually quite easy to get hold of Austin 7 parts. A lot of the parts are actually made brand new, in fact.
Oh, really? Okay.
So you can quite easily pick up the phone, and the following day, what you want will generally arrive. Obviously, some of the other things you may need to hunt around a bit more for, but it's certainly quite easy to keep your Austin 7 going nowadays.
So what's, how many members do you have at the moment?
We've got about 50 members. It's a small club, it's a friendly club, and we have runs out. We try and have a run every month during the summer months.
Yeah.
And we have a meeting as well. We meet at the Plough and Fleece in Horningsea on the first Wednesday of every month.
Oh, that's not too far away, is it, in terms of distance? So the next one would be, I guess we probably, last Wednesday would have been,
that's
presumably,
right.
the last
yes.
one. But another one, presumably, at the beginning
next
of June.
It will be in June, which will be a few days before the...
Before the big event. And so if somebody's interested, do they necessarily have to have one of these old cars themselves, or can they just join and you know, just help out, as it were, enjoy the crack?
Not at all. I mean, we're called the Cambridge Austin 7 and Vintage Car Club, so we're predominantly about Austin 7s, but not solely about Austin 7s. So if you have a vintage car, then you're more than welcome. But if you have no car at all, it really doesn't matter. It's if you have that interest, and you can come along, still join in, and I'm sure we would find a seat for you in somebody's car in one of our runs out.
And if people are interested, how do they get in touch?
We have a website, which is at www.ca7vcc.co.uk. So if you go in there, then you can email me, get an application form. It only costs £10 to join for the year. And we're always very, very keen to recruit some new members.
And you better remind us of that key date and the location of where people can see that recreation of the Austin 7 Senate House stunt.
Yeah, it's Saturday the 8th of June. It's going to be at Jesus Green. We're going to have a bit of a run around first in our cars. We're going to start at Audley End, have a run around, and the reconstruction will actually take place at about 2:30 p.m. On Jesus Green. I think it's important to say that it's also about raising some money for charity as well.
Oh, which one?
There's two charities we're raising money for. One of them is Combat Stress. and the other is Jimmy's Night Shelter in Cambridge. And we're very, very grateful to our sponsors, Domino Printing Services and Marshall Group. They're providing sponsorship, and the money they're providing is going straight to those charities.
Okay, that's really good. So no, just everything's voluntarily, and then the money paid to the charity. That's really good. Shame Marshall's hadn't got an old Austin 7 hanging around, really.
Well, do you know what they have?
Have they really?
They've got an Austin 7, yes. So maybe we can entice them.
Not necessarily for lifting, but maybe for a little parade on the morning of, that. Well, absolute pleasure, Paul, speaking to you about this. Do do let us know how it all goes. Actually, I suspect a few of us might actually pop down to have a look at all of that.
We'd be really pleased to see anybody down there.
Yeah, thanks very much indeed. Community Radio in your city, Cambridge 105, 29 minutes before 6 o'clock. Just a few weeks away now from the Big Walk for Alzheimer's UK, and in the lead up to that, we're talking to a number of people who have been affected by Alzheimer's, and I'm pleased to welcome Chris Drummond into the studio this evening. Hello, Chris.
Hello, nice to be here.
Thanks for coming in, particularly in the inclement weather. It's still sort of drizzling and raining outside.
It's had wet walking down here, I have to say.
Yeah, not quite so good. So tell us a little bit about your mother. What was it like, you know, when you were growing up, perhaps as a youngster, and what she was like?
Mum was a hard-working mum. She worked as an accounts clerk pretty much till probably about 10 years before she died. So she was always active. She always did knitting. She insisted on going to town on a Saturday afternoon, so we all had to look after ourselves.
Were you living in Cambridge at the time? Or
always lived in Cambridge, yeah. And Saturday afternoon was, you fend for yourself because I'm going to town. And she did that really up until 2 or 3 years before we realised that my mum was going down with Alzheimer's. Very independent lady, but she enjoyed everything that she did. And it was sad when she started. We noticed that she was something weren't quite right with her.
Yeah, that's interesting because I guess people change just ever so slightly in character as they get older. You know, some people perhaps get a bit more crotchety. Some people, you know, just lighten up and a bit more happy with life. What was there like a point when you thought, oh no, this is not a development in character. This is something which is not quite right here.
We looking back, we realised that something was going wrong. It's a simple thing, like 3 or 4 times a week she'd make a cauliflower cheese and she'd end up phoning my wife up and saying, it's really bad, I've forgot how to make it. And when you've made something week in, week out for years and all of a sudden you forget how to make it, she then realised herself that something wasn't quite right.
Mm.
Then it was a case of she couldn't turn the television over, so 2 or 3 times a night we'd get a phone call to say, I can't turn the television over. The one thing she never ever forgot how to do was use a telephone. But you go over there.
That's quite interesting. You get the difficulty of not being able to, I don't know, just flip a channel up button or press a number perhaps.
Well, the thing was, when we'd go over there then to see why the television wouldn't turn over, we'd find out that she was actually using the telephone to try and turn the television over. So she was using the telephone to try and do the television. A very dear friend of hers who lived opposite would get her paper day in, day out, and all of a sudden, if it was slightly late, she'd then walk across the road and complain that the paper was late. And we found out much later that she's also going over in the evening and asking her friends to come and turn the television over as well. So it's for somebody that could do everything, then all of a sudden she couldn't, and she did get very, very argumentative.
And over what kind of period of time are we talking about for this sort of thing happening?
Probably looking at the space of 12 months.
Mm. Which feels quite quick, really.
Well, it's 12 months at home, and then there was also 3 or 4 months when she was in hospital, and in the last, unfortunately, the last month of her life, she was in a home as well.
And did you seek help immediately, or did you leave it a few months?
Fortunately, my wife is a care of the elderly nurse, and
so she would have been able to see the signs fairly quickly.
She could see the
she?
Signs, although she also beats herself up a little bit because she didn't pick the signs up quick enough, especially with the cauliflower cheese coming. And looking back, she now realises that was the starting point. So, fortunately, she knew the people to contact to try and help. And as I say, it's she unfortunately ended the last month of her life in a care home. And
is that difficult? It's a tricky one, isn't it?
Because
on the one hand,
very difficult.
It's good that somebody is going to be looked after and having the constant care. But for the relatives, those yourself and your wife, it's, you know, this is my job. I should be doing this. I should be helping out.
Very much so. And it's something that's still rankles at the back of your mind. Should we have got Mum home and moved in with her? The trouble is, when you're working in, you both got a working career, how do you work that out? You know, we'd have to go to work. It's during the day that she was wandering about. I mean, if ever she wasn't at home, if I was off, I always knew I knew the focal points where to go and try and find her. And unfortunately, the last time I did find her, having gone for a walk, she had collapsed in the local co-op, and that was the last day that she was ever at home. We realised at that stage that it was going to have to be a case of she was going to have to be somewhere where she could be looked after 24/7 and not have the chance of unfortunately walking out. And
because that's the difficulty, isn't it? Because of having somebody who could potentially do harm to themselves, however inadvertently, just by, you know, wandering over and being so fixated on one issue or another that they don't see the car coming the other direction.
She knew where she was going, because she'd always gone there. She had certain times of the day when she went there.
Mm.
And that was how it was easy to sort of work out where she was going to be. The 3 months she was in hospital after the fall in a local co-op, she had enough about her to know what she wanted to do. And that was very hard for us when you knew what she was.
Was
trying.
She conscious of the fact? I think you mentioned it a little earlier on that she was aware. But as she got worse, was she aware of her developing condition?
In the 3 months in hospital, she was aware of the fact that she was worsening, and the longer she was in, the worse she got. And within the first couple of weeks of her admission to hospital, she was determined that she was going to get off the ward, and she was going to do harm to herself.
Did she have any other sort of underlying illnesses? Or
no,
that was just Alzheimer's.
Yeah, and it was it was a slow deterioration to start with, but once she'd had that fall and was put in the hospital, and then after that, it was quite a rapid, and within 4 months, unfortunately, she'd sadly passed away.
No.
And that was hard, because when you see someone that's been up and about all the time, and then sort of going backwards to asking for a sister who died when I think Mum was only about 10 years old, and that was the final part, that was her going back, that she could remember that, but she couldn't remember now. And even those last few weeks, there were certain things she'd pick up, and if you said anything out of the ordinary, straight away she'd snap at you. And she was never a person. I knew how to wind my mum up, like I think we all do, but in the end, it was very cruel to watch.
Yeah. So this was 2006, and subsequently you've become involved with the Alzheimer's UK organisation, and you're sporting a 2013 London Marathon T-shirt there, but that's not the first time you've done the marathon, is it?
No, it's the third time I've run the marathon for Alzheimer's Research UK.
What sort of times do you get?
Oh, I'm slow. I'm not a runner. I take part to raise funds. Quickest I've done is 4:44, and the slowest was this year, which was 5 hours and 4. But
presumably you're going past cucumbers and people with ostriches and all that sort of thing as part of the day. It's not all bad.
The first year I ran it was very embarrassing, because as I was coming round by Big Ben, I was actually sandwiched by two cherry bakewells, which was very embarrassing. And I've hated cherry bagels ever since.
I don't think I've ever liked them, really.
No, well, I didn't after that day, because embarrassing when you're knocked over by two cherry bagels. But this year, I actually thought there were less fancy dress runners than there had been in previous years. But it's what's nice about the day is when you see the other Alzheimer's Research UK runners.
Yes. You'll sort of sport a similar vest, do you?
Got similar
badge or something.
And you pat each other on the back as you go by, and if you see somebody struggling, you say, come on, And it's
sort of community spirit.
Yeah, of course. Very much so.
So how much have you raised yourself for Alzheimer's UK during the course of the marathons?
I'm just trying to think. Nearly £7,000, I think, over the three. I'm still collecting for this year's. I've got another couple of events.
So what else are you doing in order to raise money?
Well, fortunately, my local pub in Milton, the Lion and Lamb, they've been very good this year, and I've already done a bingo quiz down there, which raised quite a bit of money, and I've got another one of
those. I like the sound of that. I used to be a bingo caller in a previous life.
It's good fun because you answer the questions, you put them where you want, and the answers are drawn out, so you could be the best quiz person in the world, but you're not necessarily going to win. So it's good fun. And we've got a local beer festival down there, bank holiday weekends, and 10 pence of every pint is going to mine another gentleman's charity down there. So that's
pretty good. That's the bank holiday, presumably, at the end of the month.
That's
there's
right,
a couple of them around at the moment, so you have to specify which.
Yeah, it's
one
at the end of the Whitsun Bank holidays, I still call it.
Yeah, I think late spring, unfortunately. Yeah. I rather liked it when it was called the Whitsun Bank holiday.
And I've got another charity night, another bingo quiz on the 15th of June. So I've got another couple of events still to go. And I think I'm up to 2,100 for this year already.
And you're getting involved in the big walk, of course, indeed, as well. The first time, I think you're telling me, because of a bit of a clash normally.
Yes, there's normally been a bit of a clash because it's been in the football season in the past. And my first love is Tottenham Hotspur Football Club. And if anything gets in the way of watching them, then it doesn't happen. This year it's out of football season, so I've volunteered to help on the day. And it's nice to be able to help Alzheimer's Research UK out because they've helped me so much over the years. Everybody involved with
what
them,
sort of things do they do for you?
They're there on the day. That's the main thing. On the day, you get to 14 miles and the Alzheimer's Research UK cheering party are there. And it's
nice. A little group when you're doing the marathon, there's like a group of coming down.
What you look out for, you look out for the purple banner. And you look for it, and then it gives you such a lift because at the point where they are, you're going out into the wilderness of the marathon, and to see them all there is absolutely fantastic. And they help with the fundraising; they do the press releases. Sue Armstrong's such a lovely lady; she's helped me no end over 3 years, and they're all fantastic people at the charity. They really are. I can't speak highly enough for everybody that works there. I really can't.
We should say that the aim of this year's event is to raise some £30,000, which is enough to fund an entire pilot project, and they're still looking for participants. It takes place on the 9th of June, and it's a 9-mile route, note here, around the beautiful South Cambridgeshire countryside, starting and finishing in Comberton. If you don't fancy 9 miles, you can do 2.
Yep.
You can be posted around the route yourself on the day.
I've actually been asked, and whether it happens or not, I've actually been asked to lead the walk this year.
So you still get to do the 9 miles,
yes,
and a more leisurely pace, perhaps.
More leisurely
pace.
And I did go out last Monday to do a training 10-mile walk as well, so just to see if my legs still had a little bit in.
Yeah, this is an interesting thought. As you may or may not know, myself and Neil and Lottie and two or three others from around the station, Matt, I think, is another one, are going to be doing that. Maybe that's what we should be doing. We should be doing a practice 5-miler the week before.
I think you should do a little bit of training. People think, oh, it's only walking, but walking's, you're still putting a lot of miles in when you're walking. Oh, it's a leisurely pace, so you don't have to do a lot of training. Don't want to put people off by saying you've got to train for it, because that's not the case.
No. Well, as I mentioned earlier, I did go down to the gym, but there again, I was also eating the pork pie subsequently, so...
thing about the day as well, everybody's going to be there for the same cause, so everybody's going to be really together, and if anyone's struggling, arm round you, come on, you can do it. It's same with anything.
Well, Chris, thank you very much for coming in. Yeah, go ahead, please.
The most important thing about the day is the fact that we're raising money for Alzheimer's Research UK. Now, this time last year, the government doubled funding into dementia research, which is fine. It looks fantastic on paper. But when the money to dementia research was very little, doubling it doesn't really mean a lot. We don't need it doubled. We need it trebled, quadrupled, whatever. So it's important that we do raise the awareness.
It's a double thing, I guess. It's both raising the money, which is great, but also sort of flying the flag and making sure that people are aware of the issues surrounding Alzheimer's and what
they
can do to help.
It's something that's going to cost the country more money than anything else in the years to come. It is at the moment, and will do even more as we get an ageing population. So it's really important that we really raise the awareness, and through people like yourselves and Alzheimer's Research UK, we can do it, and we can try and get a cure, or if not a cure, something to sort of stop the symptoms a little bit. It's really important.
Ease it off a little bit, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, look, thanks again for coming in.
It's a pleasure, thank you.
No, but absolute pleasure from our side too. I should remind people of the website address, which is www.alzheimersresearchuk, as if one word, .org/big-walk, or just go to our own website at cambridge105.fm. Look over on the right-hand side and you'll see a link there as well. Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. It's the Michael House Festival. It's been on for a couple of days now, and I'm pleased to say that I've got the chair of the Friends of Michael House. His name is Peter Hilkin, and he has come into 105 to tell us a little bit about the festival. Hello, Peter. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolute pleasure. So the festival has been on for a couple of days this time, but how many years has it been going for altogether?
This is only the second one.
Right.
The first was in 2010. Yeah.
So there's a little space between the two. Is that sort of gauging as to whether or not it worked, or just getting everything together? Because it's probably a bit of an effort doing that.
There's a lot of work goes into it.
Yes, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So what sort of things can we expect over the next few days?
Well, the remaining highlights are a couple of plays. One is all about the production and publishing of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, a book which is the double centenary, 200 years ago that it was published. And although it has been a bestseller ever since, Jane had great trouble in actually getting it published in the first place.
I find these sort of biopics of authors, and if you like, the process of how these things come together, almost as gripping as like a police procedural, almost, you know, something like CSI or NCIS, one of these glossy American series which go through the mechanics of a crime and the mechanics of somebody such as Jane Austen writing a book which is so well known, and finding out, if you like, the backstory behind all of that really can be compelling.
And I think it's a particularly interesting one in the case of Jane Austen. She had a very special life, and it wasn't easy for her to get published. So a few people realised it immediately that it was a masterpiece, but it was a book quite different from any that had been published before.
It's quite fascinating. So when is that particular one on?
That's on Saturday evening at 7:30 in Michael House, which is in Trinity Street in Cambridge.
Are all the various events being held there, or is it dotted around just a little bit?
All except a couple, really. On Sunday morning, there's a Holy Clown in Great St. Mary's, and he is a priest, but he is going to be tightrope walking across the nave of Great St. Mary's.
A nice change from matins, doesn't it?
Yes. And then there's a big children's event on Tuesday evening. And again, we haven't got room for 150 children, let alone their loving mums and dads and brothers and sisters. So that's taking place in Emmanuel URC Church in Trumpington Street.
Yeah, there's a little bit more room there, isn't there, I think. So that make it a little bit more room for everyone. Because St. Michael's Church, ran by the Michael House Centre, it's something like 700 years old, I think, isn't it?
That's right. Just under 700 years, yes.
Yeah, it must, a lot of change. I was doing some spotting up, but I wasn't aware, actually, that it's one of these things I should have known, that there, once upon a time there was a Michael House College in Cambridge, but that sort of fell by the wayside fairly early on.
Right. It, for some reason, which I've never quite worked out, it never had students. It just had fellows, or monks, as they were in those days.
Is this what, like the 1200s or something similar,
well,
I think, aren't we?
1328,
okay.
Yes. But then it, I think most of its property was taken over by Trinity, but they wanted to build their own chapel, and so St. Michael's Church reverted then to being a parish church.
I see. That makes sense. So that's sort of pretty much stayed as it is, but you've got the cafe, which is sort of integrated with
it. Well, there was a big conversion in 2002. The church was almost derelict in the late 1990s, and then It was refurbished and renovated. It's still a church, but it's also a community centre with a wonderful cafe and exhibitions, meetings, concerts, all sorts of things go
on. Because
there.
You're the chair of the Friends of Michael House. Was it your organisation or was it an affiliated organisation that was responsible in part for some of the restoration?
Well, I suppose I had three different hats. I was a trustee, and the trustees are responsible and did the planning and the management of it. The Friends really exist to support, both morally and financially, and have some parties and garden parties and things. And then there is the Festival Organising Committee. It's just by chance that I'm on all three of those.
Yes, I know what it is like with committees. Once you join one, you just get sucked in to all of the others as well. But clearly some good work going on there. But returning to the festival itself, is there something which binds it all together? I'm thinking, obviously because it's a church, there's sort of a need for a certain element of spirituality about it all?
Well, you see, it is both a church and a secular community centre. And if you go in, you see, divided by a glass partition, it's the holy end at one side of the partition and the cafe and everyday bustle on the other side. But the two things do mesh and come very close together, and there's no hard line between the two. So it's the church very much open to the rest of the world there. Yeah.
It feels strange in a roundabout way, you know, somewhere as busy and, as you say, bustling as Trinity Street, to actually have a community centre there in the first place. I'm wondering who gets drawn to that, and in terms of geographically as much as anything else, as to who's coming in and taking advantage and using the facilities.
Well, three very distinct groups, really. There are the residents of Cambridge, for whom it's a much-loved venue for many things. There are the visitors, many of whom come in just once, have never seen it before, visitors from all over the world. And then there are university students come in with their computers, sit there with one cup of coffee for 3 or 4 hours, as well as all the other activities go on there. So, 2,500 people come in every week.
That's quite a figure, all told.
Yes.
And if people want to attend the festival, can people pop in and get tickets there, or do they have to book online?
Yes.
What's the best way?
The box office is open from 11 till 2 in Michael House. Or you can phone, and the number, you'll find it on the website or in the telephone book. Or you can write, or you can come on the night, and the box office is open for half an hour before each event.
Okay, so plenty of time to take a look through. Is there sort of like a couple more highlights that you can perhaps tell us about?
Yes. We have a wonderful playwright here in Cambridge who's published or had broadcast more than 100 radio plays and a number of stage plays, and done texts for scripts for Holby City and many other things. His name is Nick Warburton, and he wrote a play especially for our first festival, which was a sellout, and we hope this one, which is called Psalm, will also be just as popular. And that's not this weekend, but the following weekend, three performances of that.
Okay, so plenty of opportunity for that one.
And there's one other event, and that's a wonderful pair of Dutch performers. As you probably know, the Dutch speak English better than we do, and they have perfect English. And they're performing songs and stories on this Saturday afternoon at 3:30. And that's really suitable for anyone from age 5 upwards.
That's like a bit of an all-rounder then, in which case. And the songs will be in English.
In English, yes.
Nederlands.
They're very amusing and very, very varied.
Yeah, there's something about the Dutch. I always find them quite engaging when you sort of see them doing something like this. They're sort of almost like made for performance,
yes,
really.
Yes, that's right. And that's certainly very true of Jeroen Skipper.
Okay, well, that's a really good highlight to end with. Peter Hilken, chair of the Friends of Michael House. And the Michael House Festival goes through until
the 26th of May.
26th of May, so plenty to see. Thank you very much for coming in this afternoon, Peter.
And welcome back to the show. It is Matt Webb sitting in for Julian Clover right the way through until 7 o'clock. And I'm pleased to say we are now joined on the line by Lisa Rutherford, who's from Oxfam, and she's joining us to talk about the IF campaign. So a very good afternoon to you, Lisa. Thank you very much for joining us here on Cambridge 105.
Hello.
And first of all, if people aren't familiar with Oxfam, just tell us a little bit about the organisation.
Yes, so Oxfam's basically a very big organisation. We're based in the UK, but also we've got 12 different Oxfams around the world. And our overlying remit is to work with others to overcome poverty and suffering. And we do that with, we've got about 700 shops in the UK to raise money. We've got a campaigning team that do advocacy at sort of a global level to try and change the sort of systemic reasons why people are living in poverty. We're there for humanitarian work, obviously when there are big disasters, such as the current disaster in unfolding in Syria. We're there to provide water and sanitation. And we've also got programs as well in over 90 countries where we work with lots of other partners on the ground to sort of deliver health and education and human rights work as well.
And you have a lot of members of your team, don't you? You're quite a big organisation.
We are. I mean, the UK alone, like our shops, for example, we've got 20,000 volunteers, incredible people that come in and volunteer their spare time to come and help out in our shops. We've got about 700 people based in the head office in Oxford who are working with supporters, who are working with all the programmes around the world. And we've got campaigns teams around the UK as well who are working on a local level, like I do in London and the South East, to help sort of work with individuals and schools and MPs and really help to sort of try and address the root causes of poverty.
And yes, we actually do have an Oxfam shop just down the road from us where we are here on Gwider Street, just on Mill Road. So yes, very local to us here. And tell us a little bit more about the IF project that Oxfam's going to be doing.
Yeah, so basically the IF campaign, it's huge. It launched back in January, and it's Oxfam along with about another 150 different charities in the UK. And it's basically calling for an end to global hunger, which sounds a bit, sort of far-fetched. But basically, if you look at the reasons around global hunger, where nearly a billion people don't have enough food to eat every day, it isn't because there isn't enough food for everyone. It's just there's lots of unfair issues that are sort of stopping their people having enough to eat, such as things like land that's being grabbed from poor communities and being sort of people being turfed off of their land and no longer be able to farm or have food for their community. You've got crops being grown for things like fuel for cars instead of food. Tax dodging, which I know is, obviously really hit the headlines in the UK, but you've got sort of big corporations in developing countries who aren't paying any tax at all. And, in the UK, we've got the likes of sort of Starbucks and Amazon. It doesn't mean the difference between life and death in the UK, but in very, very poor countries, if companies aren't paying tax, and obviously that makes a huge difference. So there's all these different reasons that we're calling on the G8, which is being held in Northern Ireland next month, for the world leaders that come from around the world to join David Cameron to say, look, please put an end to these loopholes and stopping these policies once and for all, so that we can really sort of address world hunger.
So has this been a recent project that you've been unveiling, or has it been something that's been in the pipeline for quite some time?
Yeah, it's been planned over the past year, really. So lots of the different charities that are involved, such as Comet Relief and Christian Aid and CAFOR, we all sort of work on hunger and poverty in different levels. But it's the first time, really, since Make Poverty History back in 2005, that we've all come together under the one umbrella. So it is called Enough Food for Everyone, and it's exciting because since January we've had sort of schools doing lots of events. We've had people going and meeting their MPs, people writing to the government. We've got lots of faith organisations having lots of rallies at sort of their church day outs, etc. So there's been all sorts of people from all sorts of walks of life across the UK getting involved, and that's the main thing, really, that it does seem a bit really, really high to say, well, let's end global hunger. But if everyone joins together and plays their part, then we can really sort of hammer home that message to the people that can actually make that difference.
And what, as members of the public, can we do to help support you?
There's a couple of things, actually, and indeed on Sunday, the Oxfam Bookshop are having a pop-up soup kitchen at St. Columba's Church in Downing Street, and that's between 12 and 1:30, so people can go along, and there's sort of lots of refreshments available there, and people can go and find out about the campaign and find out how they can sign up to it. And then also on Saturday, the 8th of June, in Hyde Park, we're having a massive rally of hopefully about 50,000 people, where we can have everyone come along and plant plant a flower with their own message on, of which we're hoping to have about sort of 250,000 flowers that are going to make a giant message that we're going to video that installation and send over to the GA. There'll be like a children's area. There's lots of people coming along to speak, lots of inspirational speakers from around the world and celebrities. And it's really to have like a really mass public show of support ahead, just ahead of the GA, which is the week after, so that we can send that strong message to get David Cameron and all of the world leaders to say, look, you know, the UK public are really on board with this and really want you to take action. So people can come along. And if you go to the Oxfam website, which is just oxfam.org.uk, there's a link on the front about if, and you can click on that and just find out all the details.
Superb stuff. And do you actually have an email address if people have an inquiry or want to get in touch at all?
Yeah, absolutely. People can email me direct. So it's Lisa Rutherford. So it's L Rutherford, R-U-T-H-E-R-F-O-R-D, at oxfam.org.uk.
Superb stuff. Lisa Rutherford from Oxfam, thank you very much for talking to us here on Cambridge 105 about the IF project and what Oxfam do. Thank you very much.
Thank you.